Hello. Welcome to Literally from the North Shore, and thank you for tuning in. Today we will continue our reading of Three Men in a Boat by Jerome K. Jerome. It was published in 1889, became an instant success, and has never been out of print. The book has been categorized as a comic travelogue, perhaps the first. As our musical touchstone to accompany this reading, we will use Peter Dawson's rendition of Old Father Thames, recorded in 1933. There will be 17 episodes in this presentation, read to you by Bruce Carlson. Please join me now for episode 4 of Three Men in a Boat.
It seems to me so shocking to see the precious hours of a man's life, the priceless moments that will never come back to him, again being wasted in mere brutish sleep. There was George, throwing away in hideous sloth the inestimable gift of time, his valuable life, every second of which he would have to account for hereafter, passing away from him, unused. He might have been stuffing himself with eggs and bacon, irritating the dog, or flirting with the slavey instead of sprawling there, sunk in soul-clogging oblivion. It was a terrible thought. Harris and I appeared to be struck by it at the same instant. We determined to save him, and in this noble resolve our own dispute was forgotten. We flew across and slung the clothes off him, and Harris landed him one with a slipper, and I shouted in his ear, and he awoke.
"Watermarked," he observed, sitting up.
"Get up, you fat-headed chunk," roared Harris. "It's 9:45.
"What?" he shrieked, jumping out of bed into the bath. "Who the thunder put this thing here?"
We told him he must have been a fool not to see the bath. We finished dressing, and when it came to the extras, we remembered that we had packed the toothbrushes and the brush and comb. That toothbrush of mine will be the death of me, I know. And we had to go downstairs and fish them out of the bag. And when we had gone and done that, George wanted the shaving tackle. We told him that he would have to go without shaving that morning, as we weren't going to unpack that bag again for him, nor for anyone like him. He said, "Don't be absurd. How can I go to the city like this?" It was certainly rather rough on the city, but what cared we for human suffering? As Harris said in his common, vulgar way, the city would have to lump it. We went downstairs to breakfast. Montmorency had invited two other dogs to come and see him off, and they were whiling away the time by fighting on the doorstep. We calmed them with an umbrella and sat down to chops and cold meat. Harris said, "The great thing is to make a good breakfast," and he started with a couple of chops, saying that he would take these while they were hot, as the meat could wait. George got hold of the paper and read us out the boating fatalities and the weather forecast, which later prophesied rain, cold, wet to fine, whatever more than usually ghastly thing in weather that may be. Occasional local thunderstorms, east wind with general depression over the Midland counties, London and Channel. Bar, falling. I do think that of all the silly, irritating tomfoolishness by which we are plagued, this weather forecasting fraud is about the most aggravating. It forecasts precisely what happened yesterday or the day before, and precisely the opposite of what is going to happen today. I remember a holiday of mine being completely ruined one late autumn by our paying attention to the weather report of the local newspaper. "Heavy showers with thunderstorms may be expected today," it would say on Monday, and so we would give up our picnic and stay indoors all day, waiting for the rain. And people would pass the house going off in wagonettes and coaches as jolly and merry as could be, the sun shining out, and not a cloud to be seen. Ah, we said as we stood looking out at them through the window, won't they come home soaked? And we chuckled to think how wet they were going to get, and came back and stirred the fire and got our books and arranged our specimens of seaweed and cockle shells. By 12 o'clock, with the sun pouring into the room, the heat became quite oppressive, and we wondered when those heavy showers and occasional thunderstorms were going to begin. Ah, they'll come in the afternoon, you'll find, we said to each other. Oh, won't those people get wet? What a lark! At 1 o'clock the landlady would come in to ask if we weren't going out, as it seemed such a lovely day. No, no, we replied with a knowing chuckle, not we. We don't mean to get wet. No, no. And when the afternoon was nearly gone, and still there was no sign of rain, we tried to cheer ourselves up with the idea that it would come down all at once, just as the people had started for home, and were out of the beach reach of any shelter, and that they would thus get more drenched than ever. But not a drop ever fell, and it finished a grand day and a lovely night after it. The next morning we could read that it was going to be a warm, fine, to set fair day. Much heat, and we should dress ourselves in flimsy things and go out, and half an hour after we started, it would commence to rain hard, and a bitterly cold wind would spring up, and both would keep on steadily for the whole day. We would come home with colds and rheumatism all over us and go to bed. The weather is a thing that is beyond me altogether. I never can understand it. The barometer is useless. It is as misleading as a newspaper forecast. There was one hanging up in the hotel at Oxford, at which I was staying last spring, and when I got there it was pointing to set fair. It was simply pouring with rain outside, and had been all day, and I couldn't quite make matters out. I tapped the barometer, and it jumped up and pointed to very dry. The Boots stopped as he was passing and said he expected it meant tomorrow. I fancied that maybe it was thinking of the week before last, but Boots said no, he thought not. I tapped it again the next morning, and it went up still higher, and the rain came down faster than ever. On Wednesday I went, and I hit it again, and the pointer went round towards set fair, very dry, much heat, until it stopped by the peg. It couldn't go any further. I tried its best, but the instrument was built so that it couldn't prophesy fine weather any harder than it did without breaking itself. It evidently wanted to go on and prognosticate drought and water famine and sunstroke and zimum and such things, but the peg prevented it, and it had to be content with pointing to the mere commonplace very dry. Meanwhile, the rain came down in a steady torrent, and the lower part of town was under water owing to the river having overflowed. Boots said it was evident that we were going to have a prolonged spell of grand weather sometime, and read out a poem which was printed over top of the oracle about long foretold, long last, short notice, soon past. The fine weather never came that summer. I expect that machine must have been referring to the following spring. Then there are those new style of barometers, the long, straight ones. I never can make head nor tail of those. There's one side for 10 a.m. yesterday, and one side for 10 a.m. today. But you can't always get there as early as 10, you know. It rises or falls for rain and fine, with much or less wind, and one end is NLY and the other is ELY. What's ELY got to do with it? And if I tap it, it doesn't tell you anything, and you've got to correct it to sea level and reduce it to Fahrenheit, and even then I don't know the answer. But who wants to be foretold the weather? It is bad enough when it comes without our having the misery of knowing about it beforehand. The prophet we like is the old man who, on a particularly gloomy-looking morning of some day, when we particularly want it to be fine, looks around the horizon with a particularly knowing eye and says, "Oh no, sir, I think it'll clear up all right. It will break all right enough, sir." "Ah, he knows," we say, as we wish him good morning and start off, wondering how these old fellows can tell. And we feel an affection for that man which is not at all lessened by the circumstances of its not clearing up, but continuing to rain steadily all day. Ah, well, we feel, he did his best. For the man that prophesies us bad weather, on the contrary, we entertain only bitter and revengeful thoughts. "Going to clear up, do you think?" we shout cheerily as we pass. "Well, no, sir, I'm afraid it's settled down for the day," he replies, shaking his head. "Stupid old fool," we mutter, "what's he know about it?" And if his portent proves correct, we come back feeling still more angry against him, and with a vague notion that somehow or other he has had something to do with it. It was too bright and sunny on this special morning for George's blood-curdling readings about bar falling, atmospheric disturbance passing in an oblique line over southern Europe, and pressure increasing to very much upset us. And so, finding that he could not make us wretched, and was only wasting his time, he went. Then Harris and I, having finished up the few things left on the table, carted out our luggage onto the doorstep and waited for a cab. There seemed a good deal of luggage when we put it all together. There was the Gladstone, and the small handbag, and the two hampers, and a large roll of rugs, and some four or five overcoats and mackintoshes, and a few umbrellas. Then there was a melon by itself in a bag, because it was too bulky to go in anywhere, and a couple of pounds of grapes in another bag, and a Japanese paper umbrella, and a frying pan which, being too long to pack, we had wrapped around with brown paper. It did look a lot, and Harris and I began to feel rather ashamed of it, though why we should be, I can't see. No cab came by, but the street boys did, and got interested in the show, apparently, and stopped. Biggs' boy was the first to come around. Biggs is our greengrocer, and his chief talent lies in securing the services of the most abandoned and unprincipled errand boys that civilization has yet produced. If anything is more than usually villainous in the boy line crops up in our neighborhood, we know that it is Biggs' latest. I was told that, at the time of the great Coram Street murder, it was promptly concluded by our street that Biggs's boy, for that period, was at the bottom of it, and had he not been able, in reply to severe cross-examination to which he was subjected by Number 19, when he called there for orders the morning after the crime, assisted by Number 21, who happened to be on the step at the time, to prove a complete alibi, it would have gone hard on him. I didn't know Biggs' boy at that time, but from what I've seen of him since, I should not have attached much importance to that alibi myself. Biggs' boy, as I have said, came round the corner. He was evidently in a great hurry when he first dawned upon the vision, but on catching sight of Harris and me and Montmorency and the things, he eased up and stared. Harris and I frowned at him. This might have wounded a more sensitive nature, but Biggs's boy are not, as a rule, touchy. He came to a dead stop, a yard from our step, leaning up against the railings and selecting a straw to chew, fixed us with an eye. He evidently meant to see this thing out. In another moment, the grocer's boy passed on the opposite side of the street. Biggs' boy hailed him. "Hi, ground flour! Old 42's a-movin'!" The grocer boys came across and took up a position on the other side of the step. Then the young gentleman from the boot shop stopped and joined Biggs' boy, and while the empty can superintendent came from the blue posts, took up an independent position on the curb. "They aren't a-goin' to starve, are they?" said the gentleman from the boot shop. "Ah, you'd want to take a thing or two with you," retorted the blue posts, "if you was a-goin' across the Atlantic in a small boat." "They aren't a-goin' across the Atlantic," struck in the Biggs boy. "They're a-goin' to find Stanley." By this time, quite a small crowd had collected, and people were asking each other what was the matter. One party, the young and giddy portion of the crowd, held that it was a wedding, and pointed out Harris as the bridegroom, while the elder and more thoughtful among the populace inclined to the idea that it was a funeral, and that I was probably the corpse's brother. At last an empty cab turned up. It is a street where, as a rule, and when they are not wanted, empty cabs pass at the rate of 3 a minute, and hanging about and getting in your way. And packing ourselves and our belongings into it, and shooting out a couple of Montmorency's friends who had evidently sworn never to forsake him, we drove away amidst the cheers of the crowd, Biggs' boy shying a carrot after us for luck. We got to Waterloo at 11 and asked where the 11:05 started from. Of course nobody knew. Nobody at Waterloo ever does know where a train is going to start from, or where a train, when it does start, is going to, or anything about it. The porter who took our things thought it would go from No. 2 platform, while another porter, with whom he discussed the question, had heard a rumor that it would go from No. 1. The station master, on the other hand, was convinced it would start from the local. To put an end to the matter, we went upstairs and asked the traffic superintendent, and he told us that he had just met a man who said he had seen it at No. 3 platform. We went to No. 3 platform, but the authorities there said that they rather thought that train was the Southampton Express, or else the Windsor Loop. But they were sure it wasn't the Kingston train, though why they were so sure it wasn't, they couldn't say. Then our porter said he thought that must be it on the high-level platform. He said he thought he knew the train. So we went to the high-level platform and saw the engine driver and asked him if he was going to Kingston. He said he couldn't say for certain, of course, but that he rather thought he was. Anyhow, if it wasn't the 11:05 for Kingston, he said he was pretty confident he was the 9:32 for Virginia Water, or the 10 a.m. express for the Isle of Wight, or somewhere in that direction, and we should all know when we got there. We slipped a half-crown into his hand and begged him to be the 11:05 for Kingston. "Nobody will ever know on this line," we said, "what you are or where you're going. You know the way. You slip off quietly and go to Kingston." "Well, I don't know, gents," replied the noble fellow. "But I suppose some trains got to go to Kingston, and I'll do it. Give me the half crown." Thus we got to Kingston by the London and Southwestern Railway. We learnt afterwards that the train we had come by was really the Exeter Mail, and that they had spent hours at Waterloo looking for it, and nobody knew what had become of it. Our boat was waiting for us at Kingston, just below the bridge, and to it we wended our way, and round it we stored our luggage, and into it we stepped. "Are you all right, sir?" said the man. "Right it is," we answered, and with Harris at the sculls and I at the tiller lines, and Montmorency unhappily and deeply suspicious in the prow, out we shot onto the waters, which for a fortnight were to be our home. Chapter 6. It was a glorious morning, late spring or early summer as you care to take it, when the dainty sheen of grass and leaf is blushing to a deeper green, and the year seems like a fair young maid, trembling with strange awakening pulses on the brink of womanhood. The quaint back streets of Kingston, where they came down to the water's edge, looked quite picturesque in the flashing sunlight. The glinting river with its drifting barges, the wooded towpath, the trim-kept villas on the other side. Harris in a red and orange blazer, grunting away at the sculls, the distant glimpses of the gray old palace of the Tudors, all made a sunny picture, so bright but calm, so full of life, and yet so peaceful that, early in the day though it was, I felt myself being dreamily lulled off into a musing fit. I mused on Kingston, as it was once called in the days when Saxon kings were crowned there. Great Caesars crossed the river there, and the Roman legions camped upon its sloping uplands. Czars, like in later years Elizabeth, seemed to have stopped everywhere, only he was more respectable than good Queen Bess. He didn't put up at the public houses. She was nuts on public houses, was England's virgin queen. There's scarcely a pub of any attractions within 10 miles of London that she does not seem to have looked in at, or stopped at, or slept at, some time or other. I wonder now, supposing Harris says, turn over a new leaf, and becomes a great and good man, and got to be prime minister, and died, if they would put up signs all over the public houses that he had patronized. Harris has a glass of bitters in his house. Harris was there in the summer of 88. Harris was chucked from here in December 1886. No, there would be too many of them. It would be the houses that he never entered that would become famous. Only house in South London that Harris never had a drink in. The people would flock to it to see what could have been the matter with it. How poor weak-minded King Edwy must have hated Kingston. The coronation feast had been too much for him. Maybe boar's head stuffed with sugar plums did not agree with him. It wouldn't with me, I know. So he slipped from the noisy revel to be with his friend Elgiva. Perhaps from the casement they were watching the calm moonlight on the river, while from the distant halls the boisterous revelry floated in broken bursts of faint-heard din and tumult. Then brutal Odo and St. Dunstan force their rude way into the quiet room and hurl coarse insults at the sweet-faced queen and drag poor Edwin back to the loud clamor of the brawl. Years later, to the crash of battle music, Saxon kings and Saxon revelry were buried side by side, and Kingston's greatness passed away for a time, to rise once more when Hampton Court became the palace of the Tudors and the Stuarts, and the royal barges strained at their moorings on the river banks, and bright-cloaked gallants swaggered down the water steps to cry, "What fairy ho! Gadzooks, Gramercy!" Many of the old houses round about speak very plainly of those days, when Kingston was a royal borough, and nobles and courtiers lived there, near their king, and the long road to the palace gates were colorful all day with clanking steel and prancing palfreys and rustling silks and velvets and fair faces, the large and spacious houses with their oriel latticed windows and their huge fireplaces, their gabled roofs breathe of the days of hose and doublet, of pearl-embroidered stomachers and complicated oaths. They were unpraised in the days when men knew how to build. The hard red bricks have only grown more firmly set with time, and their oak staircases do not creak and grunt when you try to go down them quietly. Speaking of oak staircases reminds me that there is a magnificent carved oak staircase in one of the houses in Kingston. It is a shop now in the marketplace, but it was evidently once the mansion of some great personage. A friend of mine who lives in Kingston went in there to buy a hat one day, and in a thoughtless moment put his hand into his pocket and paid for it then and there. The shopman, he knows, was naturally a little staggered at first, but quickly recovering himself and feeling that something ought to be done to encourage this sort of thing, asked our hero if he would like to see some fine old carved oak. My friend said he would, and the shopman thereupon took him through the shop and up the staircase of the house. The balusters were a superb piece of workmanship, and the wall all the way up was oak-paneled with carving that would have done credit to a palace. From the stairs they went into the drawing room, which was a large, bright room decorated with somewhat startling, though cheerful, paper of a blue background. There was nothing, however, remarkable about the apartment, and my friend wondered why he had been brought there. The proprietor went up to the paper and tapped it. It gave forth a wooden sound. Oak, he explained. All carved oak, right up to the ceiling, just the same as you saw on the staircase.
But, great Caesar, man, expostulated my friend, you don't mean to say you have covered over carved oak with blue wallpaper?
Yes, was the reply. It was expensive work. Had to matchboard it all over first, of course, but the room looks cheerful now. It was awful gloomy before. I can't say I altogether blame the man, which is doubtless a great relief to his mind. From his point of view, which would be that of the average householder, desiring to take life as lightly as possible, and not that of the old curiosity shop maniac, there is reason on his side. Carved oak is very pleasant to look at and to have a little of, but it is no doubt somewhat depressing to live in for those who fancy does not lie that way. It would be like living in a church.
You have been listening to episode 4 of Three Men in a Boat by Jerome K. Jerome. Please remember that if you miss an episode, you can find it by going to our website, ktwh.org, and clicking on Programs, and then Literally from the North Shore on the drop-down list. Each week, we will post the episodes from the prior 2 weeks for you to catch up on. Please join me next time for episode 5 of Three Men in a Boat, here on Literally from the North Shore.
Down to the mighty sea. What does he know? What does he care? Nothing for you or me.